This is Free Speech Radio News for December 8th. I'm Matt Martin. Coming up, in Florida, the political pressure builds as the deadline for choosing presidential electors draws near. Mexican environmentalists urge President Vicente Fox to free two jailed anti-logging activists. High-tech workers stop a Los Angeles company from crossing the border to avoid a union, and a Canadian labor official okays the first unionized McDonald's in North America. And
this voice will continue. The microphones will remain open.
The surprise firing of the general manager at Pacifica Radio's New York station. On Thursday morning, the Florida Supreme Court was once again the focus of the nation's attention as it considered the Gore-Lieberman campaign's appeal of State Judge N. Sander Saul's decision that there should not be manual recounts in three South Florida counties. Many observers see the Florida Supreme Court as Gore's last chance, but the final push before Tuesday's deadline for choosing presidential electors is having an impact across the state. On Wednesday, a crowd of 3,000 led by Jesse Jackson and AFL-CIO President John Sweeney gathered in Tallahassee to protest a special session of the legislature aimed at approving a separate slate of pro-Bush electors. Two demonstrators explained why they came to the state capitol.
Ah, the Bush boys. Ah, they're very arrogant, and we are waiting for everyone to be honest. And that's why I'm here. I want honesty.
On the count of 10,750 votes that have never been even looked at, we sent those here as evidence, and the court made a decision without even looking at the evidence that those votes have never been even looked at. The machine threw those votes out.
Although the Gore campaign has staked its hopes on hand recounts in South Florida, charges of electoral fraud and discrimination elsewhere in the state continue to make their way into the courts. I asked Rob Lori, Free Speech Radio news correspondent and news director at WMNF-FM in Tampa, about the latest evidence that Florida's election disenfranchised thousands of African-American voters.
The most serious example, I think, has come to light in the last few days. The Secretary of State's office used a private company called Choice Point to identify convicted felons in Florida. Here in Florida, if you're a convicted felon, even though you've served your sentence, you're ineligible to vote unless you've gone to the governor and talked with the cabinet and gotten a special okay from the cabinet and the governor. The Secretary of State went to this private company, got a list of more than 8,000 people supposedly who were convicted felons either here in Florida or in other states, and applied that to the voting rolls. What happened, though, was it turns out that the list was almost entirely inaccurate. At least 8,000 people who were on this list of supposed felons had only been convicted of misdemeanors. Now, it turns out that of the people on this list, somewhere between 30% and 40% were African American.
Clearly, the Gore camp has distanced itself somewhat from these charges of racial discrimination. They don't seem to want to get into those and be associated too closely with them. How seriously are they being taken by people outside the African-American community? Is this seen as a problem in Florida's democracy that needs to be addressed?
Well, the biggest example of that came this week when a state senator, Al Lawson, said that with all the emphasis that the Democratic Party and Al Gore are putting on the three southeast Florida counties, predominantly Jewish counties, Broward, Palm Beach, and Miami-Dade, that it's also forgetting about the other examples where people were denied the right to vote, especially in places like Duval County in northeast Florida. I think this issue is growing. I think that it started with the rally Wednesday in Tallahassee, in which several thousand people were there, union members, African-Americans, women rights activists, environmentalists. I think it's growing. I think there's a feeling here in Florida that whatever happened way back on November 7th, it wasn't fair. The only people that think that it was fair were those hardcore Republican activists.
This is certainly an unprecedented level of concentration on Florida for the national political scene. How do you think this election controversy and the attention that it's garnered may affect Florida politics in the long term?
Well, I think it's a good thing because I think that we as Floridians, I mean, this radio station has paid a lot of attention to the Florida legislature, but very few news organizations do. Certainly the electronic press does not cover the legislature, and I think there's a lot of reason to do it. So I think it's going to be a healthy thing because the spotlight will shine on what the legislature has done. It's been a closed system up there in Tallahassee, a good old boy network for the most part. And people get away with a lot. A few people, really three or four people, hold all the cards in Tallahassee, the governor, the Speaker of the House, and the president of the Florida Senate. Those are the three most powerful people in Florida. So I think it's good that the national press will come in, take a look at who these people are, take a look at how objectively they operate and whether or not they play fair. I think that's going to be good. I think the other thing, too, is that it's organized a lot of communities. I mean, this the progressive community, I think, was organized a few months back when Jeb Bush began to dismantle affirmative action here in Florida. And we saw coalitions based on people's ethnicity, labor unions, women's groups coming together. We're seeing that coalition maintained. Now the question is whether or not it'll be able to maintain itself through the 2002 elections, maybe have an impact on the governor's race and Jeb Bush's future in that office, and maybe even into 2004, see if that coalition can keep up its energy and have an impact on the presidential race next time.
Rob Laura is the news director at WMNF Radio in Tampa. The election of Mexican President Vicente Fox and the end of 7 decades of rule by the Party of the Institutional Revolution, or PRI, has created a sense of possibility for progressive change in Mexico. Even though Fox leads a right-wing party committed to corporate-led free trade, his ascendance has raised hopes that issues which were closed under the PRI will once again be open for discussion. In Chiapas, the Zapatistas used Fox's inauguration to call for renewed peace talks with the government and the removal of military bases from the southern state. And Mexican and international environmentalists hope that Fox will free 2 activists who've become symbols of the fight to protect old-growth forest in Mexico. Rodolfo Montiel and Teodora Cabrera are serving long jail sentences and are at the center of a growing international movement to save Mexican forests from intensified logging. Kent Patterson files this report.
Y el resultado fue que los acusaron por portación de armas exclusivas y delitos.
Professor Ernesto Ontiveros is the president of the Mexican Association of Family Members of Disappeared Persons and a member of the Binational Border Coalition that brings together activists from Mexico and the United States. The coalition is calling for the freedom of 2 imprisoned anti-logging activists from the Mexican state of Guerrero, Rodolfo Montiel and Teodoro Cabrera. For his work, Montiel was named last spring a winner of the prestigious Goldman Environmental Award. Earlier this year, Professor Ontiveros was able to penetrate the Guerrero prison's on-again, off-again visitation policy for the 2 men.
Y las autoridades del penal no permitiéndole permitirme solo 5 minutos en la oficina del.
The prison authorities didn't even allow us 5 minutes in the warden's office. Rodolfo Montiel and Teodora Cabrera were there and informed us about the bad treatment they were receiving and the incommunication they were suffering because of the orders from higher up. The warden denied all this. Montiel had a tumor around his chest because of the blows he had received. He wasn't getting medical attention for it until a human rights activist from the Party of the Democratic Revolution in Iguala got involved.
And then Physicians for Human Rights, Denmark section, also sent a couple of doctors, which concluded that Rodolfo and Teodoro had been victims of torture, including electric shocks, beatings, threats.
Alejandro Querel directs the Human Rights and Environment Campaign for the U.S.-based Sierra Club. Together with Amnesty International and many other international groups, the Sierra Club is flooding the Mexican government with letters and staging protests on behalf of Montiel and Cabrera. Although the 2 men were convicted on drug and weapons possession charges, Querel and others maintain the activists were arrested, tortured, and framed by Mexican soldiers in 1999 for halting and detaining logging trucks in the Sierra Madre Mountains of Guerrero. When anti-logging protests first broke out in early 1998, much of the wood was going to the Boise Cascade Corporation, which has since pulled out of Mexico. Querel says that recent reports show an environmental emergency.
Greenpeace Mexico actually was able to get a hold of several satellite images of the area and analyzed the change in land in the land in a period of 8 years, from 1992 to April of 2000. And they concluded that about 40% of the forests have been clear-cut, which represents about an increase of 446%. This is clearly the first step, as we all know, in leading to a desertification. And that is one of the main problems that Rodolfo and Teodoro and the communities in the areas were complaining about, that there was no more water, that rivers were drying out, that wildlife and fish and shrimp in the rivers was disappearing.
Montiel and other members of the Campesino Ecologist Organization of Petatlan and Coyuca de Catatlan soon began receiving threats. Some were killed or disappeared, and others like Montiel and Cabrera jailed on suspect charges. But during the past year, environmentalists in both this country and abroad have made their freedom a top priority. Before taking office last week, Mexican President Vicente Fox heard from Sierra Club members about the case during a meeting in Washington, D.C. The Sierra Club's Alejandro Queral says the international environmental community is now looking to Fox for the freedom of the anti-logging activists.
Well, I know that Mr. Fox is very well aware of the case of Rodolfo Montiel and Teodoro Cabrera, and I think he is well aware that this could have an impact on the way the international community views his administration. Right now, he has a lot of political capital. He could, he's riding high on this, not only on his victory, but also on this rhetoric about human rights and environment being a priority in his administration. He's going to come in with a case that could certainly make that record look terrible in front of the international community. So I think it is in his best interests, in order to keep this political capital, to begin to make some public statements about reviewing this case, acknowledging that there have been a lot of things that haven't been addressed, a lot of irregularities, and that there have been human rights abuses.
Montiel and Cabrera's lawyers are attempting a last-ditch legal effort to have their convictions thrown out. If this fails, then pardons from President Fox might be the only route to their freedom. Meanwhile, the international campaign on behalf of Montiel and Cabrera is growing. Meeting in New Zealand late last month, 60 representatives of forest advocacy groups signed a declaration calling for the release of the Mexican activists. The signatories hailed from numerous countries, including Mexico, New Zealand, the United States, and Russia. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kent Patterson reporting.
Faced with labor union organizing efforts, U.S. corporations use a variety of tactics to discourage workers and communities from backing unionization. Between 50 and 70% of companies threaten to move out of the country when workers start talking union. But as Laura Hawther reports from Los Angeles, one group of workers has successfully fought back, and their case may set a precedent for workers throughout the country.
Employees of a small Los Angeles-area jewelry manufacturing company, Quadratech, stopped the company from moving to Tijuana to avoid negotiating with their newly elected union, the International Union of Electricians. Sandra Fernandez, a Quadratech assembly line worker for 7 years, is one of four workers fired during union organizing. She says she is thrilled with this unexpected victory.
What I'm going to remember is that we proved we could win. You can do it, no matter who you are, even if you're at a lower level than someone else. Even if you're a little ant against an elephant, it's still possible.
A U.S. District Court judge handed down the preliminary injunction, barring Quadratech Corp. from moving and ordering truckloads of equipment to return from Tijuana. The decision also indicates the workers are likely to win their case before the National Labor Relations Board. NRLB trial specialist Julie Gutman.
What we found here was that the employers' intense anti-union animus, as evidenced by anti-union statements and conduct before the election, as well as statements after the election. Right after the election, the employer's supervisors explicitly told employees that it was because of the union that they were moving to Mexico.
The goal is to have the judge issue a restoration order, which would force the company's owner, Vladimir Riel, to negotiate with the union and answer the NRLB charges. Felipe Aguirre, union organizer with the International Union of Electricians.
And if it stays, you know, we're going to negotiate the contract, grievances, salaries, mostly the dignity for the people that are working there. And if he decides to leave and it's really going to be more cost effective for him, then he's got to negotiate severance packages for all the employees and resolve all the unfair labor practices.
Quadratech management refused to comment for this story. Gino DiCarlo, spokesman for the California Manufacturing and Technology Association, says although Quadratech is not part of the association, the group is concerned the judge's ruling will drive business away from California.
We hope that this doesn't start a snowball effect on on a whole bunch of other cases against companies who, you know, decide to move their companies for whatever reason they feel necessary, mm-hmm. whether it be labor or you know, production costs or cost of doing business in California.
Kate Broffenbrenner, Director of Labor Education Research at Cornell University, says this ruling might signal a change in how courts consider such cases.
The courts have seen multinational corporations having gone too far, and that in this balancing of management rights versus freedom of association, even though historically management rights always won out when it came to the ability to open and close companies, maybe employers are starting to go so far that the courts are going to reconsider this issue.
She believes this ruling is part of a growing awareness of the effects of globalization on workers.
This case captures the central issue that concerns American workers today, which is job security and economic security in the global economy, and that it captures why in this supposed economic boom, workers in America are more insecure than they've ever been, because employers are likely to threaten to move or to move whenever they try to ask for a wage increase or try to organize a union.
Union organizer Aguirre says it is still unclear whether Real will actually live up to his threat to move the company. For now, the workers are pinning their hopes on getting the restoration order. A U.S. District Court judge will make that decision on Monday. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Laura Hauther in Los Angeles.
McDonald's and its anti-union lawyers are taking a beating in Montreal. The corporate burger giant, synonymous with low-wage, non-union work, will for the first time be forced to deal with organized workers after Quebec's provincial labor commissioner handed down a stinging ruling in which he accepted a request for union accreditation from a group of employees at a local franchise. With over 70,000 employees in Canada alone, McDonald's has fought hard against unionization and has much to lose if the Montreal case sets a precedent. Stephen Cooperman reports from Montreal.
18-year-old Pascal McDuff started the unionization campaign. After 2.5 years with McDonald's, McDuff says heading a push for unionization was a logical decision.
You know, when you work at McDonald's, you have to work with the sound, with the pressure, so that's very hard to work there. After that, you see that the managers don't respect you, don't motivate you. You see that to have a good salary in McDonald's, you have to be the friend of the manager. And in fact, the fact that we have a bad condition of health and security at work at McDonald's, when you have a problem, when you have an accident, that's like, okay, just go home and that will pass. They don't write that on the formula of Health and Security Commission.
Improving working conditions are only part of the request of the employees. They also want to entrench uniform wage increases. Employees now start at the minimum wage of the equivalent in American currency of $4.50 an hour and get a raise after 1 year. A 10-cent raise to $4.60 an hour. As soon as they got whiff of the move to unionize, the response of McDonald's was swift. McDuff says the response originated with a group of employees from Toronto they had never seen before.
First, they tried to buy us, so they give us free meals, and they motivate us to say, oh, you do a good job, Pascal, or Maxim. And after that, they try to intimidate. That's what they are trying to do now. So they aggress physically an employee. They meet people in the office to tell them that a union is 40% of about the pay that they have, to say that they will lose with a union the meal at 50%, that they will lose the pay break and a lot of advantage.
None of this comes as a surprise to the Confederation of National Trade Unions, which is backing the McDonald's employees' efforts. They say it's not the first time they've seen the strategy of using a head office strike-breaking team. Union President Arthur Sanborn.
They have a global anti-union strategy. They've used it in France and all over the place. And it's only recently there's been any unions anywhere in McDonald's in the world. I mean, and they're willing to pour tons of money.
In the case of McDuff, talk of raises and public picketing led to a one-week suspension.
A few days after the manifestation, the owner of the restaurant met me, and he said that I was suspended for 1 week because I affect the image of his store.
But soon after returning to the restaurant, McDuff received the tonic for his suspension in the form of some good news. The provincial labor commissioner ruled against the move by franchise owner Michel Marchand to hire 24 new employees. The commissioner called it an attempt to artificially reduce the majority in favor of unionizing. A subsequent challenge to the union accreditation in Quebec Superior Court also failed, and so the accreditation held. McDonald's regional office has only issued a written statement. In it, they praise the virtues of what they call their open and respectful management style. Union President Arthur Sanborn disagrees.
That's hogwash. McDonald's has a very repressive, very domineering management style, which is a which also has, I mean, it's you know, it's brainwashing stuff, right? The most important thing in this store are the hamburger patties.
McDuff's group has not been the first in the greater Montreal region to attempt unionization. Montreal has a strong tradition of unions, where close to 50% of the labor force is unionized. In 1999, a prolonged battle ensued with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters when they tried to unionize another local McDonald's. Amid union charges of dirty tricks, workers finally voted not to bring in a union. And the year before, Teamsters Local 973 won accreditation for employees of a different franchise 2 weeks after the owner closed the restaurant. Local public policy analyst Harold Chorney.
In the current environment where things are looking up and perking up a little bit, it's not surprising to me that a lot of workers, particularly younger, badly paid workers, might turn towards a union because they're not sure how long they're going to stay at McDonald's. They may stay there a lot longer than they thought.
According to Chorney, the trend of unionizing McDonald's employees might not be relegated to Montreal.
Younger workers now, are, and younger people generally, are now a lot more radical than they were, let's say, 10 years ago. There's a lot more awareness and alienation from what's been going on with the IMF, the World Bank, and these other organizations. And so there's a new kind of militancy amongst younger workers.
So although a Montreal franchise is the only one of 15,000 franchises across North America to unionize, there's much at stake, especially for a company with over 28,000 stores in 120 countries across the world. If the resolve of Pascal McDuff is any indicator, McDonald's would do well to start preparing for a long road ahead. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Stephen Cooperman in Montreal, Canada.
Mazen Al-Najjar is a Palestinian cleric and university professor jailed in Florida since 1997 on charges of supporting terrorism, charges based on secret evidence which neither he nor his lawyers were allowed to see. On Wednesday, Al-Najjar's friends and relatives celebrated after an immigration judge ruled that the government had failed to prove its case and had not sufficiently outlined the secret evidence it used against Al-Najjar. But before Al-Najjar could be released, the Immigration and Naturalization Service appealed the judge's decision, and his release from an INS detention facility was blocked. The case has drawn considerable attention from civil libertarians, and the judge's ruling on Al-Najjar's behalf may signal that the judiciary is turning against the government's use of secret evidence in anti-terrorism cases. Mitch Perry reports from Tampa.
If Al-Najjar is released, it would come after a years-long struggle to free him, which has included over 100 congressmen sponsoring legislation banning the use of secret evidence, which has been the basis for keeping him incarcerated. Al-Najjar is one of about two dozen immigrants, almost all Muslims or Arabs, who have been detained on secret evidence. No criminal charges have been filed against the men. Al-Najjar was jailed in 1997 on secret evidence as a terrorist threat to national security. He had worked with an Islamic think tank and a Palestinian charity federal agents have called fronts for the Middle East terrorist group, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. A former think tank director of that group, Ramadan Abdullah Shalaw, spent 4 years at the think tank, then assumed command of the terrorist group in October of 1995, 6 months after leaving Tampa. In an immigration bond hearing in October, government agents called Al-Najjar a terrorist, but never showed any evidence, other than guilt by association, of his links to any terrorist group. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Mitch Perry in Tampa, Florida.
Turmoil continues within the Pacifica Foundation, the nation's oldest and largest progressive radio network. Last week, Pacifica's New York station, WBAI, was rocked by the news that its general manager, Valerie Van Isler, had been dismissed without warning. The move has aroused opposition from WBAI staff and listeners, who see it as the latest example of Pacifica's national management making sudden top-down decisions without dialogue and consultation with the people on the ground. From New York, Miranda Kennedy has this report.
Hundreds of people turned out for a demonstration Thursday night at Pacifica National Board member John Murdoch's law firm, Epstein, Becker & Green, which is on the AFL-CIO's list of most union-busting firms. Murdoch himself represents HMOs. Protesters decried what they call a rightward shift in the nation's oldest progressive radio network. The demonstration was touched off by the dismissal of WBAI General Manager Valerie Von Issler. The vast majority of WBAI staff refused to support Van Issler's removal, saying it defied process and that staff should be consulted in personnel decisions. The decision was officially announced on the air on Friday morning's Wake Up Call show in a report to The Listener with Van Issler, Program Director Bernard White, and other senior staff members, who asked listeners to remain calm and see how the situation unfolded. On Monday, listeners, staff, and community members held the fifth in a series of meetings on the situation around Pacifica and WBAI. The meeting, which was recommended repeatedly on the air as an outlet for listeners' fears and concerns, brought out about 400 people. Tension was high in the room. When program director Bernard White spoke, he informed attendees that he and the rest of WBAI management had sent a memo to Bessie Wash the previous Thursday once the decision had been finalized. White's memo requested a meeting with Wash immediately to discuss the attempted removal. Although Wash granted a meeting for that Saturday in New York, White did not think the negotiations were successful.
She refused to reverse the action. She said that she wasn't going to do that and that someone would be in on Monday, that Valerie Van Issler would have to train until December the 31st.
According to White, Pacifica's proposed actions at WBAI did not correspond to the success of the general manager's impact on the station.
This comes on the heels of a unique time in BAI's history, where we came in with a balanced budget, having in October the largest October fundraiser in the history of WBAI, and possibly in the history of public radio.
The memo to Wash from WBAI management stated that Pacifica's proposed action was in contradiction to a recent management statement promising responsiveness, dialogue, and better communications. It accused Pacifica of compromising the hard-earned goodwill that WBAI had re-established with its listeners. After last year's three-week lockout at the network's first station, KPFA, in Berkeley, the memo stated, many lost faith in Pacifica, which took an obvious toll on WBAI's membership and income. Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman, also speaking at the meeting, recalled last year's events in Berkeley when General Manager Nicole Sawaya was removed from her position by Pacifica. This action led to the arrest of staff and the closing of the station for 3 weeks. If the listeners allow this action to happen at WBAI, Goodman said, chances are we have lost the station forever.
And they marched down the streets of Berkeley, more than 15,000 people, and said, this voice will continue. The microphones will remain open. And so, in that sense, it was a tremendous victory for community radio. And tonight we say the same thing. We are yours. You are us. We are you. And the only way we're going to survive is by doing it together.
Michael Ratner, a lawyer with the Center for Constitutional Rights, has consulted with a number of Pacifica employees who believe they have been wrongfully terminated or harassed by management. Dan Coughlin, former Pacifica National Network News Director, was removed from his position after writing a headline about an affiliate's boycott of Pacifica last year. Ratner is also a consultant lawyer on the case of Amy Goodman, who has filed harassment and censorship charges against Pacifica management. Ratner, who was also consulting on Van Issler's case with Pacifica, says that the removal of Van Issler is demonstrative of a much larger issue with Pacifica, where a move to the center and changes in the national board combine with their disregard for personnel process. Even major corporations, Ratner says, do not treat their employees as badly as Pacifica does.
On the most immediate level, they're trying to push out people who aren't utterly loyal to them, and on a deeper level, they're trying to change the place politically. I think there's an attempt to move it toward not to the right, but to the center, Democratic with a capital D.
Van Issler has filed an appeal of the termination with the Pacifica National Board. Pacifica has 5 days to respond, but as of Tuesday, Pacifica Executive Director Bessie Wash was unaware of the appeal. Several calls to Wash's assistant at Pacifica Publicity were not returned. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Miranda Kennedy in New York.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 reporters on 4 continents and in 14 states are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. For more information on the strike, please check out our website at www.savepacifica.net/strike. That's www.savepacifica.net/strike. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz. Thanks to Vanessa Tate for technical assistance and to the National Radio Project for leasing us space. I'm Matt Martin. Please tune in again next week.